This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
United Nations agencies are condemning attacks by ex-Seleka fighters in the Central African Republic. The agencies are calling for restraint to prevent further escalation of violence.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, at a checkpoint in the Sinai Peninsula, militants killed 12 Egyptian soldiers, and European nations have not been able to unite over how to handle the flow of migrants crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, 12 Egyptian soldiers were killed and 8 others wounded today in an attack on a checkpoint in the Sinai Peninsula. Officials say militants used all-terrain vehicles armed with heavy machine guns in the attack. 15 militants were reported killed. No group has claimed responsibility. Military sources say the Islamic State-affiliated group called the Emirate of Sinai is behind a surge in attacks in the Sinai in recent weeks.
United Nations agencies are condemning attacks by ex-Seleka fighters in the Central African Republic. The agencies are calling for restraint to prevent further escalation of violence. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Tensions in the Central African Republic between Muslim ex-Seleka rebels and the Christian anti-Balaka militia have been rising since September 12th. That is when a group of ex-Seleka entered a hospital in Kagabandoro in the north of the country, demanding treatment for one of its members. Over the past month, there have been a number of unsettling incidents, including attacks against civilians and acts of violence against humanitarian workers. The UN Human Rights Office says the worst incident occurred on Wednesday. The agency's spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, says hundreds of ex-Seleka members attacked a camp for internally displaced people, the prefect's office, and a camp run by UN peacekeepers. She tells VOA 30 people were killed, including 18 civilians and 12 ex-Seleka fighters. Many others were injured, and houses and offices were set on fire and looted.
The sudden escalation is particularly worrying in this context because of the period of calm that preceded it, which is why we're calling on the armed groups to stop right now, to exercise restraint, to prevent a further escalation, and to go back to the table to resume the dialogue.
The UN Children's Fund also condemns Wednesday's attack in the strongest terms. It reports armed ex-Seleka men attacked a secondary school in Kagabandoro while teacher training was underway. It says 3 teachers and the director of the regional pedagogical center were killed. Before the month-long eruption of violence, the country's armed groups were participating in a process of disarmament, demobilization, reintegration, and rehabilitation. United Nations officials are urging the ex-Seleka to resume their participation in that process, which is seen as a crucial step toward peace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
France and Italy are squabbling today over migrants. As the flow of migrants continues across the Mediterranean from North Africa, European nations have not been able to unite over how to handle the problem. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments. From Rome, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about tensions between France and Italy.
Well, France seems to suggest that Italy is not doing enough to properly identify and process the large number of immigrants that are coming into Italy. The Interior Minister, Bernard Cazeneuve, on Thursday said Italy must do more. That created a bit of a reaction from the Italian Interior Ministry. The Minister, Angelino Alfano, said Italy won't be lectured about how to process its migrants and insisted that Italy is really a very safe and secure country because of the measures that it's taking. Incidentally, Angelino Alfano suggested that Italy was not going to become the Ellis Island of Europe, accepting migrants from around the world. But the European Commission, the arm of the European Union, said Friday that Italy's rate of identifying refugees and asylum seekers was close to 100%.
For our audience members who are not familiar with Ellis Island, Ellis Island is off New York City, and it was one of the major entry points for immigrants early in the 20th century to enter the United States. So it's a very famous historical spot. But let me ask you more about the tensions between Italy and France. Italy has more migrants within its borders than France, is that correct?
That seems to be the case. We've certainly seen that this year, the flow of immigrants, the first port of call, of course, has been Italy. And we've had more reports that migrant reception centres are on the verge of collapse, hosting around 165,000 asylum seekers. Many NGOs say they haven't been paid. They're looking for more money coming from the government. The president, Sergio Mattarella, has said that Italy's been left to its own devices and isn't getting enough support from other countries in the European Union. And Italy seems to be under more pressure. I've seen today that in October, the arrivals were 5.5% higher than the same period last year.
It seems a bit ironic that these other countries are complaining about Italy when many of them are tightening or closing their borders to the migrants that would like to leave Italy and go there.
Yes, there are many migrants who've made the journey into France. They've crossed the border illegally and they've been sent back to Italy. Some are saying that they've been sent back two or three or four times. They still have their sights on reaching France or Germany or Sweden or the UK, where they still imagine there are going to be better opportunities for them than in Italy. I'm not sure that all of them have been processed, despite the claims of the Italian government, because, as we know, migrants try and avoid being fingerprinted and identified in Italy because it means that they will be forced to stay here and won't be able to continue their journey.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
In recent months, when protesters in Zimbabwe encountered tear gas and gunshots, they turned to social media to express their dissatisfaction with unemployment and inflation. The government of President Robert Mugabe has adopted new policies to control the internet. Also, Parliament is considering criminal penalties for those who criticize the government on Facebook and other social media. The research director for the African Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, Joseph Siegel, talks to VOA's David Arnold about new limits to internet access.
In response to a spate of protests that have been occurring in Zimbabwe over the course of the past year, to the economic challenges and the difficulties the government is having in paying civil servants, et cetera, the government has tried to enact policies to curb access to information through social media. They are doing this in a number of ways. You know, there's a new information communications technology policy that has allowed the government to require that all internet gateways and infrastructure are going to be controlled by a single company, which the government has control over. This is going to give them more opportunities to block internet services like WhatsApp or Twitter or Facebook and limit the sorts of information that they find offensive.
Is a government policy enough to regain control of this political narrative?
But this is happening in combination with a proposed legislation, the Computer Crime and Cyber Crime Bill, which would further legalize the government's ability to control the internet. It would actually authorize the government to seize anybody's mobile phone or other electronic devices, private communications more generally, if they are suspected of being the source of information deemed to be untrue or destabilizing to the government.
I understand also that they've raised prices on cell phone data.
We've seen information revolution unfold in Zimbabwe and other parts of Africa. It's been a game changer. In the past, so much was dependent on state broadcasting messages. That has changed. The government is responding to what they see as this threat and trying to make it more difficult for people to get access to information. Many Africans are living on tight budgets and increasing the cost of internet service providers, other internet fees, would dramatically limit their abilities to have access to this service. The effect will be to help the government regain control of the information that's getting out to the public. I think what we are seeing is a cat and mouse process. As the government tries to restrict information through this new ICT policy, people are looking at different methods of communicating, and the government in turn is also trying to borrow technologies from China, Cuba, and Russia to try to control internet access.
The ability to use WhatsApp or Facebook or Twitter enable them to communicate from the safety of their homes. Do you think that with an effective law banning a lot of this activity that would drive people back to the streets?
I think that's an open question. Clearly, we see the youth taking a lot of the leadership, supporting these protests and share their information on social media. I think the question will be just how well organized they can be, what role opposition parties may play in the process. Frankly, how severe the conditions are going to be. The economy is contracting. There are concerns that we're going to see a new round of hyperinflation as the government introduces its new bond notes. And as those conditions on the ground deteriorate, then people are going to be more emboldened or feel that they just have few other alternatives than to protest and to demand some sort of change.
That was Joe Siegel in Washington talking to VOA's David Arnold about Zimbabwe's shrinking internet.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. At a checkpoint in the Sinai Peninsula, militants killed 12 Egyptian soldiers. Attacks by ex-Seleka fighters in the Central African Republic is condemned by the UN. And European nations have not been able to unite over how to handle the flow of migrants crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Data from the 2016 Global Hunger Index reveals that many nations are not on course to end hunger by 2030, the deadline set by the UN's Sustainable Development Goals. The report is released yearly by the Washington-based International Food Policy Research Institute, or IFPRI. Researchers have measured the hunger rates of over 100 countries around the world based on four indicators: undernourishment, child mortality, child wasting, and child stunting. Klaus von Grebner is a research fellow for the International Food Policy Research Institute and is one of the report's authors. He spoke with me about some of the findings, including some of the major obstacles to end hunger. He also identified countries that are improving in food security.
Given the hunger situation measured by our index, it has gone down since 2000 by 29%. So on average, the whole world hunger situation has improved by 29% compared to 2000. What we then found in our report is that if the reduction of hunger globally continues with that speed, we will not reach the goal number 2 of the Sustainable Development Goals to end hunger by 2030.
Also, the report showed that there were some countries that had very high levels of hunger, some even alarming levels of hunger. What countries were these countries?
The countries with the alarming level are actually seven countries: the Central African Republic, Chad, Zambia, Haiti, Madagascar, Yemen, and Sierra Leone. Out of those seven countries, five countries in Africa south of the Sahara, and only Haiti and Yemen are not in that region. For the sake of completeness, I also have to say that we originally investigated 13 countries more, and they are also in the report. We couldn't give a ranking to them because we did not have all the values. But at least 10 out of those 13 countries are by no means countries where one would say the situation is rosy. Some of them would most probably fall also in the alarming or serious area, but you don't get researchers to do a ranking if they don't have all four values. You have, for example, Burundi with a stunting percentage of 75.5%. Compare that with the average of all countries of 28%. That's more than double. You have child mortality in Somalia, extremely high. But those countries did not have all the four indicators that we measure, namely undernourishment in the general population, mortality under the age of five, wasting and stunting.
Why is it that these countries still have these alarming rates of hunger, considering the knowledge, the technology, and resources that are available today to be able to provide people with food?
The main reason is, in most cases, armed conflicts. When there's a war in the country and an ongoing war, and then people are driven out of the country, you have refugees, like, for example, from Niger into Chad. Chad, a country that has already a very serious situation, and the refugees come in there. In addition to that comes also then natural catastrophes like Haiti with the earthquake years ago. So that is one recipe. The second recipe is bad governance, meaning there's either no government or a bad government, or there is corruption going on. These are the ingredients. They are now becoming even more severe, or could become more severe, with the climate change conditions.
The report also notes some bright spots. Can you tell us some of the countries that are improving in the area of being able to provide food for people?
So you had a high percentage reduction in hunger in Rwanda, Cambodia, and Myanmar, and you had the lowest percentage reduction in Namibia and Sri Lanka. And then you have countries where the government really wants to have change to the better. Our institute is doing cooperation currently with Rwanda, with Malawi, with Ethiopia, and with Bangladesh. And there you have the prime minister directly involved. You have the various governments working together. There's a clear strategy of what should be achieved.
So overall, then, you do see some countries reaching the UN Sustainable Development Goal deadline of 2020 of zero hunger.
It could be all countries who can achieve it, but it needs the political will. It needs sticking to the promises they have made. Business as usual will not bring us there.
Klaus von Grebner is a research fellow for the International Food Policy Research Institute. He spoke with me from Berlin, Germany.
Tunisia is considered to be the only country in northern Africa and the Middle East to have had a successful Arab Spring. Though the country has a young but stable democracy, its economic situation is difficult. Yassine Ibrahim is Tunisia's Minister of Development, Investment and International Cooperation. Reporter Mohamed El-Shenawi asks him about this challenge and plans to reform the economy.
When we came 1 month ago to the government, we started by going through a parliament, and we had the green light for this new investment law. This is to have a fast track and a one-stop shop for these investors. And as I said, today Tunisia need to have an investment from private sector, locally and overseas. And our aim is to explain to our friends that Tunisia could be a gateway to the MENA region, to Africa also.
What kind of economic sectors that Tunisia is inviting foreign investment to?
First of all, infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Second, in PPP. It could be in PPP. And second, in the healthcare, in education, also in agribusiness. Tunisia is well known for the agriculture and for the agribusiness.
You said that Tunisia would need about $20 billion to boost the economy. How would Tunisia generate such huge amount of funds?
It wasn't me that said this amount. It was the European Parliament who voted last week a kind of Marshall Plan for Tunisia for $20 billion, and we need this money to grow, to have an inclusive growth by investing. And now we are negotiating with all our friends and partners to have this to raise this amount for the Tunisian economy.
How do you rate the current level of U.S. economic assistance to Tunisia and what your country is hoping to get from Washington?
I think there is, first of all, we have to say that the gap between the political perception and the political support of the United States to Tunisia and the economic support, the gap is quite huge. So we need from our friends to support this new democracy, this small country in this region.
Tunisia faced security threats that negatively affected foreign investment and tourism. How would you describe the status of stability and the flow of investment and tourism?
We are improving in security, really, since 1 year and a half, I will say. But we need more commitment from our friends to help Tunisia to be in a better situation. As you know, Tunisia is not very far from Europe, and the security of Europe is also the security of Tunisia.
Tunisia is hosting the Tunisia 2020 International Conference next month. What is the purpose of that conference and the incentives for more international cooperation with the emerging democracy in Tunisia?
The objective, the aim, my expectation is to raise the economic image of Tunisia, to close this image to its political perception in the world.
That was Yassine Ibrahim, Tunisia's Minister of Development, Investment and International Cooperation. He was speaking with reporter Mohamed El Chinawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenor, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Let's Talk, we will talk about marriage. When is the right time to get married? What are the ingredients necessary to make marriage a successful, lasting partnership? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing marriage. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Join with leaders like President Sirleaf.
Malaria stops footballers from scoring and students from learning.
And join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
United, we can beat malaria.
The lyrics subjects could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time
with David Bandy.